Welcome to the Motoring Podcast, your weekly discussion of motoring news. This is episode 123 on Tuesday, the 8th of August, 2017. Hello, I'm Alan.
Hello, I'm Andrew. And this week we will be talking about how Tesla is looking for cash, new car registrations from July, also London gets charged up, and car cybersecurity seems to be being taken seriously by governments, amazingly. But we have a touch of follow-up, though, don't we, Alan? And
we do.
I shall leap straight into it. If you remember, there was a VW exec who was arrested in America just before he flew out of America because they realised that he was in the country and they quickly got together the arrest warrant. And he was arrested, I think it was in the airport or on the way to the airport.
But yeah.
Oliver Schmidt. And he was the former chief of the Volkswagen Group's Environmental and Engineering Center in Michigan. He has actually pleaded guilty to lesser charges or reduced charges as part of a plea deal to do with the whole diesel emission scandal. And he has admitted to or pleaded guilty to conspiracy to defraud the United States and violating the Clean Air Act. And also to aiding and abetting wire fraud, which was expected to be part of the conspiracy charge, but that was separated out. So
yeah,
yes. So there are questions. There was originally quite a lot of, you know, he's going to spend hundreds of years in prison.
169 years in prison was the maximum that he could have got for the 11 felony charges.
But that's now going to be 84 months. As a maximum, or he faces a maximum of 84 months, and a fine ranging from $40,000 to $400,000.
Nice and specific.
Yes.
As well as deportation post his sentence as well. So as soon as he served it, he's out. Which, to be honest, I'm not sure he'd put up too much of a fight about, really.
No, not quite.
Did you see he's going for sentencing on the 6th of December?
Yeah.
Which seems like a long way away, especially given he was arrested in January. But I don't know. I've been watching too much Suits recently because everything seems to happen within like 20 minutes there. And it's just like, what?
Yes, and I don't suppose there's quite been so much of the same shouting that goes on in Suits.
No, there was less shouting.
I disagree with you, therefore I'll just do shouting to get my way. I don't think that probably
happens.
Now
walk along a corridor. Walk along a corridor. It's not quite the West Wing, but yeah, I'm getting there.
Right, next.
In other, yes, quite. Move on. In other follow-up and other legal news. Try again. There's the Uber Waymo. Waymo, of course, which is the self-driving part of Google, which I say just about every time we do this. Uber Waymo case goes on. It seems at the moment that Waymo are accusing Anthony Lewandowski, who's the chap at the centre of all of this, of setting up Otto, his self driving car, pseudo self driving car, startup as a ruse, because it's reckoned that he had actually signed up, met with Uber executives and Uber lawyers, and then before Otto had even started, okay, before it was even a thing, before he'd even resigned from Google Waymo at the time, and before he even downloaded the 14,000 files, which nobody denies that he did, before and after. So it's all getting really, really sticky there, about just what happened when and how much Uber had in the whole Otto thing, and just getting whether or not they intended purely to get that tech straight out of Waymo. Naturally, of course, Uber deny that. Uber is also denying other things. The current chairman, is denying that former chief executive officer Travis Kalanick will ever return in that post. He's saying that no, that's definitely not going to happen. So he may well be back at some sort of, I don't know, chief guru person on high who doesn't really have any say in anything, but he's there as a figurehead as well. It's still a possibility whenever he comes back from his...
well, there's going to have to be one hell of a change or appearing to change in attitude and everything to the public.
Big time. Because not only that...
There's lots of issues in Silicon Valley is right in the firing line for all sorts of behaviour and what is acceptable in polite society. And Uber is one of those companies that has brought it to the fore and really rammed it down people's throats that, you know, these things need to change. This sort of attitude isn't acceptable. No. And he hasn't helped that.
No, they've been making bankers look pretty good lately.
Well, yeah, quite. That's well done.
Did you see tonight's one, by the way? So just as I was sitting down to start my prep, that's not quite fair to do final prep and write my notes for tonight's show. Do you see that Uber are sunsetting its lease, its vehicle leasing arm?
Oh no, I didn't.
So it was leasing vehicles, or it has been leasing vehicles to people to drive for Uber. They are, as I say, sunsetting that after losses which are 18 times worse than expected. So the pressure really is on these guys, and they'd be rather crazy to. They are in big trouble unless they make some serious changes. Garrett Camp, by the way, is the name of the co-founder, and company chairman, whose name I forgot earlier on.
Yeah.
So yes, big news, lots of stuff I have to change at Uber. Here endeth the follow-up for this week.
Yes.
So new news is sticking in Silicon Valley, though, isn't it?
Yes, we're going to move on to Tesla and the Model 3. And we are not going to give a first impression from looking
at
the picture.
It's amazing! It's got a screen in the middle of the dashboard! It's amazing! Sorry.
We're not going to do that, that's right.
Oh, sorry, Dan. I thought we went out on The Verge. Oh, Dan.
But what has been announced by Tesla and the erstwhile boss... I was just trying to think how I was going to phrase it there without getting us into trouble.
Mr. Musk.
Without thunder and lightning being rained down upon us.
So Elon of Musk, yes.
Yes, quite. What he's said is that they need to raise a further $1.5 billion to sort the production of the Model 3. And I presume people have seen the wonderful graph of the growth in how much they're going to produce.
Yeah, don't show it to a math teacher, anyone.
Don't show it to anybody with brains, because it had no time scale, no numbers, just it's going to get better.
It's going to get better very slowly to begin with, then it's going to get better very, very quickly, and then it's going to slow down because we're going to be bestest.
Yes, because we'll have all the cars in the world.
Yeah. Well, that was... Oh, I know you haven't got into the story yet, but... Did you see this morning? You may not have done this morning. That supposedly they're looking to make. Was it Musk was muttering about 700,000 Model 3 a year, which Ed Niedermeyer was pointing out is the same as the combined sales of the BMW 3 Series and the Audi A4 globally.
Yeah, well,
okay, no, distribution channels, anyone? Oh, no.
No. And we don't have to go down the ridiculous, there won't be enough batteries or charging points to get over that problem. We don't have to mention anything nonsensical like that. We can just talk about, no, you won't. No. We'll just leave it at that. No, you won't. Stop it now. Stop it, because it is doing more harm to the brand than anything. But anyway, yeah, they need this extra $1.5 billion cash because, well, they'd only just got some of the permits just before any of the Model 3s came off the production line anyway. So they the inference is that they do not have in place the manufacturing capability, whether it's the plant that they need, whether it's the people they need, whether it's the supply chain backup that they need. They don't have it ready. So this whole 6 months of production hell that Elon Musk is talking about, I would strongly suggest it's going to be much longer than that. Because I read somewhere that it's 2019 before we get any in this country.
Probably. They're so sold out anyway. Did I say sold out? Allegedly oversubscribed. Anyway, that we'll see.
How can
what
you
happens.
Oversubscribe to something that's going to be continuously made?
I honestly don't know.
Anyway. Yeah, we're not talking about marketing language again, are we? Oh, no, let's not go down that one.
Shall
let's
we
not
move
go down
on?
That rabbit hole.
Shall
yes.
we move on? So Tesla, so in summary of what we haven't talked about, is Tesla are going to be selling $1.5 billion in bonds to professional investors, which will be paid back over 8 years. No interest rate has actually been decided on.
I'll be interested to actually see how well that's taken up. Because I notice more and more from business websites and reports that senior analysts are beginning to question the whole business model and execution thereof.
Yes, it does seem. And also Mr. Musk has said how close to the wire he has been with Tesla in the past. Or because of Tesla in the past. So we'll see what happens there. I think, as ever with this, we do feel that we need to point out that Tesla really does need to survive. It does need to do this because it is towards the forefront there. Not maybe as much as its publicity says, but it is a key player, a vitally important player in the electric vehicle market. And
if nothing else from public perception.
If nothing else from public perception and perspective.
Anyway, let's move on because I don't want to get down too much.
No, that went down. That went down far more of a rabbit hole than we intended. Anyway, this week, Toyota and Mazda have been in the news quite a bit, and we cover lots about new up and coming car companies, and lots about car companies that do cool and funky stuff rather than people that just get on with making cars for everyone. So
let me just get this straight. Toyota and Mazda.
Yeah. So this is consolidation.
So what car
of the
are
Japanese
you going
car
to
industry.
Own soon? And what car Mazda. Do you
own? A Mazota. Or a Toyota.
Anyway, carry on.
Anyway, I knew that was going to be brought up at some point. So, Toyota and Mazda have entered what they're calling a business capital alliance. So, the business alliance part of it comes because they're going to invest in US manufacturing joint ventures, electric vehicle technology, connected car technology, safety technology, and as well as expanding their complementary products.
Is that going to be when someone says complementary products in this instance, do you think it means like the K car route and that sort of thing, more closer to home and say the Asian market where
it's not
that sort of idea then. It's not the going to third world markets and
so from their own press release. Or what they say is, currently Mazda is supplying a compact sedan to Toyota in North America. In addition, Toyota is to supply a compact commercial two-box van to Mazda in Japan. Beyond this, the companies will further explore the possibilities of other complementary products on a global level. I think it's co-branding. So somewhere Mazda don't sell a vehicle, or Mazda wants to sell a vehicle that Toyota doesn't necessarily sell there, then they'll sell the Toyota with Mazda badges. That kind of setup, rather than anything else.
Right, that's happened in the past. I mean, we've been part of that sort of thing.
We have with Isuzus, for example. So Bedford Rascals were Isuzus.
Yeah, and then there was the Honda Rover time, and there was
kind of
things like that. Does that ever work really anywhere?
Yeah, I think.
Do you think it does? Because I mean, it's not really worked very well in this country, but I don't know whether it's because we get all sniffy and silly about things.
It's because we get all sniffy and silly about things, Andrew. I think that if it was to happen in Thailand or the Philippines, people wouldn't care.
Okay. Yeah. They just want
nearly as much as here, especially not when it's something like nobody gave a monkeys about the Vauxhall Frontera, for example. Which was exactly that kind of deal with the Zuzu.
Yeah.
So nobody bothered. It was with the Rover, that was different because of all the manufacturing here. The Frontera was built here in local market, but it wasn't Isuzu. Trust me, because I can buy all the bits.
Okay. But, no, that's great. Because I've always wondered about that, because it's just never seemed to... It just never really taken off over here, and I didn't know whether it was because we were being silly or whether the products weren't diverse enough. You know, it wasn't a product that we just didn't have. It was, oh look, you can go into one showroom and get this, and the next door showroom's got exactly the same but with a different badge.
I think it's because we're sniffy about brands, and it was the brands that were doing it.
Okay.
Yeah. Especially, yeah. So that was the business part. The capital part, by the way, means that they'll be mutually buying shares in each other.
Okay.
So Toyota will buy 31,928,500, so quite a few shares of newly issued common stock by Mazda, and then it works the other way as well. So Mazda will acquire a whole bunch of shares in Toyota.
Okay, and that's expected to be done, signed and sealed, as it were, as share acquisition by Monday, October the 2nd, according to the press release.
Yes, it will be. That's the plan that's the line they intend to do on that. But what this also underlines is the consolidation again of the Japanese car market, which we've started to see. So some of the smaller manufacturers are starting to join up with some of the bigger ones, obviously. So it's very much splitting into three camps.
Is that because the Japanese market is oversaturated, do you think, or just general car? It's gone. We're going through the cycle of we've split, so then we consolidate again, then we'll split again, then consolidate again. Do you think we're in a cycle, even though it's quite a long cycle? Putting your business analyst hat on.
Yes. I think there have been an awful lot of small manufacturers have survived for a very long time in Japan. I think that this is the start of that consolidation, but it seems to be happening in a relatively grown-up way. But there's a number of different ways it's happening. So, of course, when we see Mitsubishi, for example, being absorbed into the Renault-Nissan Rebel Alliance, then that was one thing where they were pretty much purchasing Mitsubishi because Mitsubishi had done naughty things, or had guessed at numbers, actually, rather than anything worse than that. And we've also seen, and this is a slightly different setup, with Mazda aligning with Toyota. Less of that sort of absorption that's happened with Daihatsu and Toyota recently as well, and more of that alignment. Honda seems to be the third way right at the moment in this, and I can't think of who Honda is aligned with right at the minute. Certainly out with the Japanese market, somebody will tell me that they all share K cars, and I'll go, yes, I can completely believe that. Not 100% certain. Mazda's also been in the news today because it has announced something quite major. It's announced that it's made a breakthrough where people like General Motors and Daimler haven't. And that's that it wants to become the world's first car manufacturer to commercialize compression ignition petrol engines. So compression ignition is kind of how a diesel engine works, where the pressure that you put the fuel air mixture under is what makes it ignite. So the idea is that Mazda's trying to get, Mazda believes that it can from 2019, commercially from 2019, not just experimentally, actually have these in production. So they've got
these on in test mules now. They are driving these now.
That's what people have... Well, I saw somebody earlier on saying that they've had test mules on the road for the last 4 years.
Because I know when the whole diesels are more efficient than petrol discussion came along and the whole CO2 started, mm-hmm. thanks to our fantastic politicians.
Yeah.
Thinking only one level. It was mentioned, oh, you know, how much more efficient they are, and people were saying, but petrol's smoother, and then things happen to diesel engines to make them smoother and more cultured, perhaps is kind of one way to put it.
Yeah.
Cultured and more acceptable in normal cars, and it wasn't sounding as though you just started up your Massey Ferguson. But people were talking about around that time as well, but can't we take this technology that makes diesel so special and stick that in a petrol? And I remember this being discussed, going, yeah, it is possible. So what you're saying to me is, a Mazda are the first to have said, yeah, we think we've cracked it to the point where we are going to be selling it.
Yes. Yes, that's it. So it works like at low temperatures, it seems, from what I've gleaned from what's been being discussed.
And this is not temperatures set to
no.
trigger certain software programs make people think they're on a rolling road.
I think they're Mazda, so they'll hopefully be sly, and certainly nowadays more aware of that. But the idea is that the spark plugs are only really needed at low temperatures, possibly when you're initially starting. But after that, then it is the compression. So a bit like glow plugs are needed when you start up up a diesel. So compression. The idea is that the fuel economy should match that of a diesel engine, but without the nitrogen oxides, without the particulates. Coming out of there. The name of the system is I'm never sure if it's homogeneous or homogeneous. Homogeneous charge compression ignition, or HCCI. It seems really rather clever. What haven't I mentioned?
I think if they can pull that off, that's going to be brilliant. Because I know Mazda stuck by their guns with their diesel engines to the point where they didn't introduce them to America, because this all came out to when we've talked about Dieselgate, because they just said, look, we can't do it, and we think larger engines are the future. You can't force it down to smaller engines, and they stuck by it and they maintained that. And I admire them for that, because it must have been maybe not tempting, but easy to have gone down a route that perhaps did not actually achieve everything that people thought it would.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's kind of curious that they do that. That they've really stuck to that. Okay, what we're going to have is a naturally aspirated, maybe traditional sized engine, for want of a better term.
What's their diesel 2.2? Isn't it in the 6?
2.2 in the 6 and the CX-5. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a Skyactiv D. Skyactiv G is the current petrol engine range, which is available right across the range as well, and that's what's in the MX-5 and stuff. But it's one of the things that I've been... Oh, the new one's going to be called Skyactiv X. There we go, that's the one thing on my notes that I haven't mentioned. And have no plans to sell it to anyone else right at the moment. One of the things that I've been noticing this week is actually just how much more efficient that Skyactiv is than the normal, shall I say, 2 liter petrol I've been driving this week. I hadn't really appreciated before now, really.
Oh, good. Something else for you to gloat about the MX-5. Great.
Yeah.
Yippee.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, moving on.
Quite.
To a subject that possibly one or two people may have picked up, I've mentioned in the past. May have. I know sometimes I'm a bit ambiguous about some of my thoughts, particularly on cybersecurity and vehicles.
Hmm.
And connected and automated vehicles.
Yes, no, it never noticed that you that you mentioned that anytime connectivity comes up.
See, I just need one of those cartoon things where the steam comes out the air.
I can picture it every time. That's it. You see an announcement like that, and it's Andrew making an angry tweet in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's like, oh, that was predictable.
Yes, quite. But interestingly, though, the government, in the form of the Department for Transport, in conjunction with the Centre for the Protection of National Infrastructure, which is easier to read, easier to read than say, clearly, has put out guidance last, this was the back end of last week, on the key principles of vehicle cybersecurity for connected and automated vehicles. No, sorry, it came out Sunday. It was published.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
Interesting time to publish it. But this basically lists a set of principles that make it clear what the government is expecting from car manufacturers to do as far as security with connected and automated vehicles. And having read through them, and I hope everyone's sitting down while I say this, they're actually fairly reasonable.
And understandable as well.
Yes, they have. It has been, the link for this will, obviously as ever with all these things, will be in the show notes. But it is written in plain English, in fairly simple terms. And I think when we've discussed it beforehand, we only came across one or two points that was possibly a little bit ambiguous.
But you could understand why as well.
Yes, yes. There was, yeah. But the principles they talk about are a fairly common sense approach. I mean, how did you put it to me, Alan, before when you were talking about this? You said it was think cybersecurity, but just insert vehicle.
Yes, well, it was. It does look an awful lot like the very similar guidelines that you see in the defense security industries about the same stuff. It's good security practice, and what's quite nice is that it's not just all about what it is that runs over the wires or over the or gets beamed between things. You know, it covers right the way through the organization, and that's the way you put in good security. I shall take my work hat off and stop lecturing people on that, but but it is. I mean, right, one, organizational security is owned, governed, and promoted at board level. I mean, yes!
Yeah, and they will be held responsible.
Yeah, and you will be held responsible for it. And that's principle one, and I think that's a darn good start. And then it goes through risk assessments, all sorts of fun things like that. Honestly, it's good in that we will take even a novice in this kind of stuff 10 to 15 minutes to read them all, and read them and understand them without the need for explanatory notes, as opposed to this being a wonderful cure for insomnia, mostly because you'll just want to hit yourself very hard over the head with it, which is what happens with an awful lot of these kind of documents, particularly when they're published by the government. The other thing that's really nice about it is it does give you a whole list of applicable standards and guidance that you can go off and find out more about. So if you are into networking and all that kind of fun stuff and this, it's they are relating everyday standards in this sphere back to vehicles, and I think that's great because there's this feeling that a car, a vehicle, is somehow not just a node somewhere on a network, and it really is. It's just that it happens to have four wheels and it can move around a wee bit. I mean, the defense world have been used to this for quite a while. They have many different nodes that can move around, some on water, some in the air, some on wheels, some on tracks, and some on feet. And it's great to see that thinking being applied to vehicles in general. And that's gone way into the work world. So I should
really I also like the fact that they talk about the life of the vehicle. And whether it's constantly, because principle three, and I'm not going to go through all of them. No, don't worry, because it's not listed.
I was restraining myself.
But it mentions that organizations need product aftercare and incident response to ensure systems are secure over their lifetime.
Yeah. And security's for life, not just for Christmas.
Exactly. And that's brilliant to hear, because cars are bought and kept for a long time. Although I can see with legislation changes that may shorten down. I don't see people holding on to classic cars from 20 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, like they do now in another 20, 30, 40 years of this era. I can see that changing. But I think it will be driven by legislation more than. And now I'm going off on a slight tangent here, but
you are.
I can see that's been driven by legislation as much as anything. But do go and have a read. It's actually sensible.
It's more interesting than you'd think it is.
It's sensible, and it'll be interesting to see the SMMT's response to that.
Yeah.
At some point,
I blow in hope it's positive.
It better be.
Yeah. Quite.
Talking
Speaking
of which,
the SMMT, that was beautifully segued, Mr. Clues.
Thank you.
It is. So, last week on the 4th of August, so it was Friday?
Yes.
Anyway, last week, the registration figures came out for July here in the UK. And it is not a run of little happy smiley emojis across it. It's rather the opposite. There were 161,997 new cars registered in July. That is a drop year on year of 9.3%, and that's the fourth consecutive monthly fall that we've had in 2017. Demand was down across business, fleet, and private. I mean, business was down 23.8%, fleet down 10.1%, and private down 6.8%. So last year, when it kept increasing and increasing and increasing, and everybody was going, where's the bubble? I think the bubble was about 4 months ago, right at the moment.
Mm.
And I think that the bubble was hastened along by our fine political leaders.
Yes, I think there's a couple of issues into that. I don't know whether we can still yet call this a trend until we see September's.
I think you've got a point there.
This month's is going to be poor because it's August. It's always poor.
But this is year. Well, yeah. But this is year on year.
I understand that. But I think what will be key was, because September is new registration as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think that will be key. And I don't know, maybe it's just a vibe I'm feeling, but I don't see it's going to be up.
No, I'll be amazed. There is a point in here, by the way. The Mike Hawes, SMMT Chief Executive, his little quotation of the month that you always get on the SMMT page for this, he does point out that the falling consumer and business confidence is having a knock-on effect on demand in the new car market, and the government must act quickly to provide concrete plans regarding Brexit. I think that kind of thing, that fear and uncertainty, is really not helping us.
I think that's just a general country, though. It's not specific.
It's a general country. This is not specific to cars.
Car industry. I think people's confidence is down because, you know, what's going on. You know, and the car manufacturers can't try and negate that by seeing, you know, wonderful thought out policies, actions, or a plan to say this is how this is all going to be fixed. I mean, it doesn't matter what side of the argument you're on.
No, that's a side argument.
At this moment in time, this is not about whether you think it was a good idea or not, because that's irrelevant now. But this is just about how this is being handled right now, which doesn't seem to be being handled at all.
No, exactly. Shall we move on from that, though?
Yes.
Quickly, and let's talk about the best sellers. So the best seller, the top 10.
No,
so
they're not sellers. Before we get letters.
Oh, gee, why do I... It's because it's titled. They title the table best sellers, and when I'm not... When I'm trying to think three steps ahead, I just read the top of the table. I'm sorry. The top 10 most registered vehicles.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. It wasn't... I know it's the way it's written here, so it's not you. Don't worry.
Yes.
But I just didn't want us getting angry letters.
No, quite. Thank you, everyone. Because there is always at least one person who goes, actually, it's registration figures, not sales. And you're right.
Yes.
So, anyway, top 10, whatever they are. Number 10, with 2,607 registrations, was the Audi A3, number 9, Mercedes-Benz A-Class, number 8, Vauxhall Corsa, number 7, Mercedes-Benz C-Class, number 6, the Kia Sportage. It always amazes me just the contrast that you get in this. Mm. 6 is at 3,155 registrations. 5th is the Volkswagen Polo. 4th is, drumroll everyone, Ford Fiesta. Yes, the second month of that new model changeover is still there, knocking Fiesta confidence. It amazes me how much further down the Corsa is these days. I don't know.
Well, did you see there was actually on that point, that was something I was going to mention. Did you see the Richard Alcock article?
Yeah.
Because really that tied in with the whole PSA now owns Vauxhall Opel. And it's just, I will put in the link to that in the show notes, because it does start you thinking. And yeah, personally, we've been worried for some time, and we'll get into the nitty gritty soon. But we've been worried some time about Vauxhall PSA in this country.
Yeah. So Ford Fiesta is at number 4 model changeover. Number 3 is the Nissan Qashqai. Qashqai by name, Qashqai by nature. 4,000.
Is that the new? Do you think that's the new facelift now?
Possibly, but to be honest, if it's just a facelift, they can transition so easily. Number 2 is the Volkswagen Golf. That is the new one. 5,236 registrations. And number 1 with 5,251 registrations, so only a small gnat's pube in it, is the Ford Focus. Year to date, it's everything in the usual order. Starting from the top, Fiesta, Focus, Golf, Qashqai, Corsa, Astra, Polo, C-Class, Mini, and A-Class. Minis are obviously down this month.
Yes. Right, should we go through the...
Do we have to? Right, shall we just nail the really bad ones? Because this is... every month we look at this and we colour it in pink and green at the extremes, and there's an awful lot of pink this month. So... And we were talking about Vauxhall Opel, and we were talking about PSA a second ago. So let's pick out those ones. Vauxhall down 41.58%, and it's not because their cars are rubbish these days. Peugeot down 29.71%. DS down 56.81%, and Citroen down 25.63%. So I guess that's a relatively good showing, really. It's just not great reading.
It really worries me, because every car company is obviously a business, and the people running these businesses have to answer to shareholders. And if we've got companies that are not selling cars like they should be, cuts are the obvious and immediate steps that these companies take. I mean, we are not talking, this has just been a couple of months blip here.
This has been a
serious issue, particularly the DS Citroën, Peugeot to a certain degree, and definitely Vauxhall. I mean, the mother company...
to mothership, yeah.
Cannot afford to prop up. I mean, it's one of the reasons GM wanted to bail from Opel Vauxhall anyway.
Yeah.
So
I mean, let's not be totally, you know, we're saying that, but Vauxhall still command, as a single brand, the second highest percentage of the UK car market after Ford. You know, for the month. So, I mean, 12.46% of last month's registrations were Ford. 11.05% were Vauxhall.
No. That's last year.
Oh.
This year, 7.12. Ah,
this is what happens to the... Sorry, it's the way the table's laid out.
Yeah. Just,
oh, 7.1... 7.1
Audi. Audi. Ooh.
Audi are second.
It's 7.96. Percentage share. A premium brand. This is Vauxhall's problem. This is,
yeah, this, is Peugeot's.
This is Ford's problem. This is, you know, all those car companies in that mid-range that, you know, you keep
They're not, by the way. Sorry. Volkswagen at 8.7.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So they're ahead of... They're ahead of... yeah. Sorry. Next one's...
So VW are second.
Still, that points...
Audi are third, and Vauxhall are behind Audi. But, the, yeah. I mean, the point's still there that Vauxhall is behind Audi.
Yes. Well, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is... You know, we couldn't see that 10, 15 years ago, could we?
That's down 5% year on year. 4% year on year. Yes, wouldn't imagine that. The trouble's image, not the cars either.
Yep.
Everybody's... new Insignia was launched. Great reviews. Really nice things said about it. Perfect for driving from the top of Norway to the UK. They were, had journalists everywhere saying good things. And I really... want that to be the case, but you don't desire a Vauxhall. That's
nope,
the problem.
Massive problem there. They need to make interesting cars, and they're not interesting at the moment, are they? I mean, they may be competent and very good in certain areas, but they're not interesting. They're not something that makes people go, yeah, I want one of those. I don't care that it's not got, you know, a BMW propeller on the front.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter, and that's the I don't know where, you know, if we knew the answer to that, we'd be rich, but you know,
yes, we would. We would. So that's, I think that'll do us nicely for focusing on the doom and gloom there. On the plus side, Seat up 32%, Skoda up almost 21%, Toyota up 20%.
Yeah.
Lotus up 2,700%.
Yes, congratulations to Lotus on the award
cars.
For the most ridiculous percentage of the month.
I know, not even Aston Martin at 86.67% could get there. But
I know, because I started at the top and I thought, oh, that's really good, we'll have to mention them. And then you come down a few more lines and you go, oh, well, that's that thunder stolen.
Yeah, I mean, Audi up 11.35%. Year on year. So, you know, Volkswagen Group, this whole Dieselgate thing really is not hurting their registration.
It's hammering
is
them, isn't it?
Yeah, they're up everywhere. Volvo down a smidge. Yeah, it's a spread and it's split. You know, you've got your Porsche up 65% almost at the other end. So it seems that the luxury end of what's listed isn't being hit that hard. Lexus up 9%, Land Rover up almost 8%.
But Jaguar down, though. Jaguar down 16.
Jaguar down a bit. I don't know if that was just getting over a peak from last year, if there was a particular launch last year. But generally speaking, luxury cars sales up.
Or premium.
Premium car sales up, thank you.
You get another lattes.
Mass market, not so good.
No.
Yeah. On which happy note, no other happy note to that I can possibly spin on that set of stories.
No, not a good month. But like I say, I'm really waiting for September.
Okay.
September's will, I think, dictate whether this is a full on slump or is it just a normalisation after the incredibly high figures.
Oh, I tell you what, I should have checked the percentage alternative fuel vehicles, and I think it's
5.5%
up. 5.5%.
Oh, yeah. So you're up to 4.something% on the year on year.
That original, before I went silly and doubled it, 5%, which I thought was still quite generous then.
Almost no backtracking.
I know that the recorded figure is 10%, but you know, but the discussion leading up to that figure was also recorded, and at one point, I started off at 5%. So whilst I won't have achieved what I stated and we wrote down, I'll still be quite pleased with what it is, I think.
Yes, no, it is a good thing. We're talking of alternatively fueled vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Some good news out of London for a change.
Yay!
From the Mayor of London, who we are not adverse to
critiquing
and giving term reports on.
Must we do disagree better. With the way many of his policies are phrased.
Yes. But what he has stated is that there will be money allocated to not all the councils, but some of the councils, to put in 1,500 new residential electric car charging points by 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing. Because one of the comments from last week, or one of the... It wasn't comments, but one of the points that people jumped up and down and screamed about the whole 2040 end of days time was that there won't be any chargers. However, sticking chargers in isn't that relatively trickier thing to do.
No.
And can be quite quickly executed if there is a plan.
Yes.
So that's good. That's good news for London.
Well, these are rapid charging points.
Yes. I just wish it would, they would come outside London.
Did you notice there's another good one that it was just hidden away? Did you see the boroughs of Richmond upon Thames, Hounslow, and Westminster have been updating their heritage street lamps and refurbishing them? One of the things they've done two things: they've put light emitting diodes in them, so they're energy efficient, which is good. And the other thing they've done is they've also integrated EV plugs into them.
Right, because so I thought that was a pie in the sky thing.
The oldie style thing. No, it's been done in Richmond, Hounslow and Westminster so far, I believe.
Because that was one of the ways that people talked about, but I just thought that that was a little bit of a, well, there's electricity by the street, that'll do.
It was for a bit, but they've actually done it.
Okay. Good. Well, if that can work, you know, the more ways it can be done, the better. Although well, we I'm waiting for the... have you tripped over an electric cable that wasn't your fault?
Oh, don't go there.
Because lampposts generally aren't on the edge of the curb. They're usually sat like... back, aren't they?
It depends.
Property walls. So, we'll when see. We finish this call, let's set up a legal firm for... charging accidents.
Shall we talk about charging and hopefully now having no accidents whilst charging?
That would be good.
It would. Are you going to explain then?
No, you can.
Oh, okay. So we alluded to it last week. For the last few months, we have been planning a plan, and we have been planning a plan to. And I look back at when we did some of the original maths for this, and it was November last year.
Yes.
Which is quite scary. I hadn't realised we'd been planning a plan for quite that long. But we wanted to try and do something relatively momentous. Which it becomes momentous.
Depending on your point of view.
Depending on your point of view, yes. So our aim, our plan, what we have planned, is to take a... pure, normal, everyday electric vehicle, in this case a Hyundai Ioniq EV, right round the outer edge of the mainland UK as is practically possible in a week. So it's about 2,000, it's about 2,500, maybe a bit more miles. It's about 69 hours worth of driving, and goodness knows how many hours of charging as we go round. And we'll be starting from the Ormskirk Motor Festival, and I should have written down the date. The date would have been a sensible thing to write down.
Sunday the 27th, I think.
On yes, thank you.
We will be at the Ormskirk Motor Festival on Sunday the 27th.
so you can come and throw stuff at us. Sunday the 27th of August, and we will be finishing back in or around Ormskirk, or wherever we've run out of charge, on Saturday the 2nd, or Sunday the 3rd, if things have gone wrong, of
very
September.
Wrong. They will be for me, if that's the case.
Especially, yeah, well... Yes, especially as the card's meant to be collected from me on the Monday.
Well, just as a caveat for that, though, but already we know, because the way this is, because we've got such a tight timescale constraint, we will be leaving Monday morning, driving south.
So stay off the roads on Bank Holiday Monday, please.
We will be setting off early Monday, I think.
Oh, yeah. I want to get most of the way past Wales before this is...
Well, that's the thing. We can't travel into a lot of Wales. From Bangor all the way down the full Welsh coast until you get to Swansea, there isn't another rapid charger. There are only normal chargers, which does not fit for us on our... because we're looking at about a, if everything goes to plan, about 150-mile range on a full charge.
Yes.
So we are going to need a couple of rapid charges a day.
Yes.
To get far enough along to be able to do this.
And I don't know why you're scared about Wales, because the bit that
I'm not
scares
scared about
me...
Wales, because we're going to come down the through the borders. So, because there's rapid charges that way, but what we want to do is we want to see what are, you know, how viable is it today, now, not 2040, right now, how viable is it to use a car that's got about 150-mile range? How viable, you know, how good is
with
the
current infrastructure? Yeah,
how good is the infrastructure? How good are the cars right now? And should more people be thinking about electric vehicles actually? And we are have this perception of 5, 6, 10 years ago about what it was like to have an electric car.
Yes, absolutely. And it's about... And so many people say, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. My use case doesn't, you know, what I do doesn't fit with electric cars. And we want to see just what you can do with an electric car and how inconvenient it is right at the moment, and I'm really hoping we find it's not very inconvenient at all. I'm terrified. Andrew's terrified, although he won't admit it.
No, I'm fine.
But it should be... You're not. You just let me do all the terrified for both of us. But it should be great fun. We'll be loads more information coming out as we go. We've got, Hyundai have been very generous with the help so far. We've got others lined up as well.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. And if you happen to be the PR for a hotel group, please, please do get in touch. That would be wonderful.
Yes. Sleeping in the car is not plan A.
No. I can imagine this supermarket car park plugged in at one end. And I will be packing a sleeping bag. Right. Anyway, that's enough about us. So one last bit on there, because that takes us into the middle of the show. Please, folks, don't forget to subscribe and support via our Patreon. What we're really looking for is one extra a patron every month. That would just be fab. One extra patron, that's everything starts from $1 a month for us on via the Patreon system, and that gets you an update every single time we publish a podcast, which is normally twice a week. And it improves from there, including being able to watch us record this live, because that's fun, I think.
And it's the start of the month, so you're getting a whole...
And it's the start of the month, so you're
getting
a whole
month free.
You get this first month free, so why not do it? Why not try it? If you go to motoringpodcast.com, then the Become a Patron button is the orange one on the right-hand side of the screen. Andrew, try again. Andrew, long-term test car.
Yes, update number two. This is the
there are
Subaru,
39 points in here.
The Subaru Outback 2-litre D SE Premium Linotronic. I've been practicing all week.
I'm sorry, I hadn't bothered opening this, the system we use for our running order. I hadn't bothered looking at this. This is, oh wow, yes, okay, cool.
You need to scroll down to the second list.
Do I?
Yes. That's why it's so big.
Okay, right, fair enough.
Right, I can just do a bit of housekeeping. I have two sets of miles per gallons now. Week one, I did 405.2 miles, which gave me 36.15 miles per gallon, which included a lot of motorways, but that also included a lot of summertime motorways where people seem to like to queue.
Sitting still, then?
Yes, and not travelling very fast, and then travelling again, and yes. But as I said last week, and you can go and listen to last week's show if you missed it, the technology, the EyeSight technology, was brilliant on that, for that stuff. So week two, I have done 354 miles, which has returned 30.88 miles per gallon. And
yes,
that...
you are down the southwest in the tiny little wiggly lane.
Yes, there are lots of very tiny lanes with town driving, no dual carriageway, no motorway, no nice, smooth A roads for cruising along. So I'm not that surprised. Plus, there's lots of hills where I am.
And just to remind everyone, this is the Subaru Outback 2-litre diesel with the Lineartronics. That's the CVT gearbox.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. This week I'm going to talk about the exterior and the interior. Because last week we just did a general introduction to the car. So for anyone who doesn't know, the Outback is a raised up estate type car that Subaru do. They no longer do the saloon or the non-raised up version of the Legacy. So it's just the Outback now. And I tell you what, every time I come up to it, I just get reminded of the original Forester in idea and concept. That it's a slightly raised up. It's a big estate. It's, you know, it's nice, lots of glass and things like that. And it just reminds me of that idea, which I'm a fan of. This is before the Forester became a full-blown SUV is now. That's just something that I get reminded of. And obviously because it's a raised up estate, it does have a bit of plastic cladding. But this is actually quite tastefully, I think is perhaps the word to put it.
It's not OTT.
No, because it's round the bottom of it. It's around underneath the bumpers at the front and back and along the sides, and it's not as though they've put masses on the wheel arches and things like that. So
it's the bit that needs the protection.
Yes, it's where it's needed rather than for just the look. And another thing I've noticed about it is it looks a lot narrower than, say, C-Class or 3 Series or A4s. It looks quite a narrow car. I mean, perhaps the height is helping a little bit with that, but it isn't a massively wide car, which has made it very easy to drive around the narrow lanes, which has been handy. But it's, you know, it's a proper estate shape, so it's almost a squared off back. It's not one of these lifestyle estates that sort of is a glorified fastback. It's
almost coupe, yeah.
So I think it's quite a handsome look. I mean, it's not stunningly good looking, but I think it's one that will last the test of time, which is, you know, it's a Subaru. These cars are bought and kept for long times.
Much to their disgust.
Yeah, I mean, I think Subaru's, you know, secretly very proud, but then sort of going, oh God, please someone buy another one.
Just buy another one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the interior, it's easy to get in, as you would expect, front and rear. The doors are actually quite light to open, but they don't feel flimsy or, you know, cheap or anything like that. So it's easy for the kids actually to get themselves in and out. Obviously, if you're not in car parks, don't let children touch doors in car parks, everybody. God. You know, the whole where you see people parking over two spaces. Well, I do that rather a lot in the corners of car parks, just so no one can ding. The rear, talking of the rear, because I have the little people, there's a nice big bench in the back. and it's easy for them to step up and get into. There's plenty of space, even with one of them in a car seat. They can all get themselves into their seats without having to break out World War III and other lovely family moments like that. Mm-hmm. There is a transmission tunnel, as one would expect, because this is the symmetrical four-wheel drive. But it's not overly intrusive. It's not a hugely wide, tall one. It's easy to get round, so that's no problem. It wouldn't be a problem for adults either.
No.
There's nice big side windows which help create this sort of airy feel, or help with the continued feel of being airy, because there's lots of space for the whole kicking of front seats. That doesn't happen very much because they can't reach.
Not once you've broken their legs, it doesn't.
No, quite. But there is tons of room with the seats. There's no issue that way. They don't feel cramped in the back. And up front, where the important person sits, she's very happy in her comfy heated electric seats.
She's got heated seats, so she's happy.
Yes, quite. And with them, you can really find a nice, comfy driving position, as you would expect, because the steering wheel is adjustable as well. Nice leather feel to that, and it's got floppy paddles. But I'll talk about that next week, probably, when I discuss.
That's a relief.
That side of things. dashboard. It's quite a simple layout. Things are where you would want them and expect them. So there's a big rev counter. There's a big speedo. You've got your temperature gauges. And there's a little digital display in between the two big dials, which you can adjust. You know, anyone who's driven, you know, a new car recently, there's always a split in displays. Bits that just for the driver, so it'll have like the next action on the route. Actual speed is a digital display, is a figure. Things like your instant miles per gallon, that sort of thing. Your trip information, that sort of
all
stuff.
All the stuff that you scroll through once and go, oh, it does that, and then you set it to one thing and leave it forever.
Yeah, that stuff.
Yeah, good.
And then when we just go across the dashboard into the central console area, that's got the 8-inch touchscreen, which is controlled by, the menus are controlled by buttons on the side of it, which are exactly as they were when we drove it briefly.
In the off-road day, across much of the range.
I really like that little touch, because it is a physical section of the dashboard you're touching to move the one, so you don't actually have to be looking at it, which is the problem that touchscreens can bring up. The aircon and heating controls and heated seats and that sort of stuff, that's below that, and that's, you know, as you would expect, nice, simple buttons, dials, easy to use. Again, usually you press it once and it's done type thing. But it all works well. Doesn't feel horrible. Neither does any of the other materials actually inside the dash, or inside the cabin. Not every material is mega expensive, but I really feel that it's going to last. Again, the exterior will last the test of time. I think the interior will as well.
We've always said that, and I know from previous experience of ones my parents had, that it might not be the sexiest slush molded dashboard that you get in a German car, but at least you feel that it's going to be like that in 10 years' time.
Yeah, absolutely.
No matter what you've done to it.
Absolutely. There's a little cubby hole below that, which has got the 12-volt charging socket, two USBs, and an AUX cable interface. And that all works fine. Again, controlled by the infotainment thing, and the screen. Sorry,
infotainment system.
Yes, that as well. There's actually a sunroof in this one, electric tilt and slide, which is nice.
How big is it? Is it just a sort of single one? Or
yeah,
does it go
it's not panoramic. It's just a.
It's not a panoramic.
Just what you would, what we in the 80s and 90s would expect.
Oh, okay, so it's a 1990s size sunroof.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, it's adds a bit of air when you want it to, and you can, if the sun's beating down too much, because sometimes I have found a little bit of reflection off the screen because of the angle of the dash.
Yeah.
That, you know, you just shut it over and you can see again, so that's no problem. The boot is, as one would expect from a large estate, big. And it's got, as I mentioned, I think I mentioned this last week, but it's got the clever underfloor storage. And I've found the electronic...
Does it hold a baguette?
It holds more than a baguette.
Oh, okay. That's
it holds a podcasting studio and filming equipment.
And yes, sports balls. I have no comment to that.
No. But the electronic boot door actually has been really useful.
It's one of those things that you think is just a terrible gimmick until you actually get used to using it.
Yes. And now, and if you can time it right, then you're not stood there waiting for it to open. Because I know Major Gav is worried about this, but it does have door pockets in from the back doors and the front doors. But I know that was a concern of Major Gav to know whether there was door pockets available. So surprises this last week. There's no USB sockets for the rear passenger. There's only the one 12-volt...
That's normal.
...charge. No, it's not.
Unless you're paying extra in a Land Rover, that's
no,
normal.
No, it's not. It's not. Cars I've had on loan have had that stuff.
Okay.
There's one 12-volt charging socket in the cubby box that you rest your arm on.
Yeah.
That you can trail cables out of. So it can be done. But I would have expected them to be on the back of the cubby box where the air vents are.
So is it the USB or the 12-volt pot socket that you're really looking for?
Either.
Okay, just a chargy point.
Just charging points for the rear passengers.
Okay.
But, yeah. There are a couple of curry hooks, but they're quite flimsy and they are right by the back door of the boot. So
slams.
Yeah. There's a...
Sorry.
Yes, quite. Yeah, they need... Yeah, I'm not impressed with those. Things I have found very useful, though, with the car, apart from the boot, is the electronic folding mirrors.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to the wonderful way in which the Southwest have made their roads.
It's electronic folding mirrors are one of those things to not be sniffed at.
No. But I'm a little bit surprised that they don't automatically fold when you switch the engine off, though.
Yeah, some of them you can do that in the, you know, deep in the bowels, and sometimes it's actually a dealer setting that they can set it to do that for you. I noticed that the BRZ I have parked outside is exactly the same, and it's quite annoying. You just kind of... I like it. I mean, none of my cars do that, but I like it because it's a visual sign that your car is locked.
Yeah. Yeah. The other... one of the things is I've actually been approached by a few people asking about the car. So that's always been nice. Asking about it, saying that they quite like the look of it and things like that. So, you know, I down here with... Middle England that seems to have descended upon.
It is that time of the year where all the middle classes go to the southwest.
Yes, and me.
My point entirely.
Yeah. But people seem... I think they just haven't seen them. Or they haven't seen enough of them. And it's, in a good way, raised a few eyebrows and made people think of it. So that's been interesting to see, that it's not just my... thoughts on the car and how it looks. That's been good. The other thing I really like is the smoothness of the Lineartronic system.
Just a bit of a... even better than the normal auto once you get used to it.
Absolutely. Change. There's none of that going on. It's, you just keep going.
No.
Yeah. And I like that a lot.
Yeah, I like that a lot when we drove them before with the Lineartronic, because it's a bit like Mazda earlier on with us saying about how the you know, how they've managed to, they believe they've managed to solve something that bigger manufacturers couldn't. Lineotronic and stuff and CVTs make lots of sense for Subaru, because Subaru used to be packaging, you know, a dual, you know, a transfer case and a gearbox into a standard size saloon car or estate car. And for them, being able to have whatever gear is needed is fantastic for those let's off-road moment that people take it in or towing or any of these things, because it saves people that effort and having to do that in bad weather and stuff. So really glad they seem to have nailed it.
Mm.
Okay, we're running long tonight. It's been a busy week. So a couple of relatively quick things. Designer's mood board.
It's back.
Then I still haven't got a proper screen for that. News this week is that VW Group veteran Oliver Stefani has been appointed to head up Skoda design. So his background is that. This is after all the other musical chairs the other week. But Oliver has been with Volkswagen Group since 1992 and has been overseeing the whole of the Volkswagen brand since 2002. That's included stuff like the Polo, the Jetta, the Tiguan, current Golf, as well as the only interesting Volkswagen model, which is the Up, in my mind, of course. So he's been moved from that sort of corporate, the VW AG stuff, to Skoda. So
he's no longer sending the template out to people and saying, "There you are, just stick your badge on that."
You may very well say that. I couldn't possibly comment. I don't know if we'll see any difference whatsoever in Skoda design. But of course, it'll be 2-3 years before we actually see his work hitting the motor shows and the road.
Ding. Right. Mm. Moving on. A bit of WRC news, actually. This is a bit of a surprise, actually, I thought. But Jarmo Leitinen is going to leave his role as the sporting director at Toyota Gazoo Racing immediately after the German rally, which is the 17th to the 20th of August. He's helped them get to a cracking start, considering, you know, fresh back into WRC. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure quite why he's leaving, whether this was a difference in opinions, or whether he was never going to see the full season out anyway, or whether something else has come up for him that's just too good to ignore. So we'll see with that. They will announce a replacement when they have lined somebody up. But there we go. Nice and brief.
Yep.
Nice and brief.
One last story for the week then. It's time for the and finally. And this is one I spotted this morning, which is just a little bit ridiculous, which is that that a driverless van was seen driving around parts of Virginia and Arlington and Virginia earlier on in the week. It turned out that what was happening was the Virginia Tech Transportation Institute was actually trying to capture people's responses to driverless vehicles. So what they had done is they had taken a Ford Transit Connect, the little one, and in the back of it they put a whole load of cameras pointing out in different ways through the tinted window, so you couldn't see them from outside, but you could see them from inside. And then what they'd done is they'd modified the cabin slightly so that the driver sat on a lower, thinner seat, and then basically wore a seat costume that was kind of see-through, you know, that sort of dark mesh in front of his face, so that he could see out, people couldn't see it. And then was driving around to try and see how people reacted to a vehicle that just seemed to be travelling around with no driver. And it was caught. It was spotted by someone from NBC4 News in Northern Virginia, who got some film of it. And then ran after it and tried to check and worked out it was a guy in a suit costume, because whenever they looked in, they could actually see his arms coming out the bottoms in the steering wheel. But it's interesting that they're looking at not just the effect of driverless vehicles on the road, but also what their effect is on other people round about and what people's reactions are to them as well. So that was just a little bit ludicrous. There's a link to video and stuff. There's a link to the news story, and it includes an auto-playing video, so I'm very sorry about that. Let's start the page. So by all means, please visit and go see that from the show notes. That rounds it up for this week. Gosh, we've run a little bit longer than we normally do. But yeah, that seems to be it. Anything else I've missed out, Andrew?
No, I don't think so.
Nope. Cool. So everyone, don't forget that between now and next week, you can give us any feedback and share your thoughts on the show at Motoring Podcast on Twitter and Instagram, on Facebook, and on the contact page of motoringpodcast.com, the hub of all our activities. Please don't forget our Patreon, our one new patron a month. Let that patron be you, please. Via motoringpodcast.com or motoringpodcast.com/support. If, of course, you can't do that, you can't support us via Patreon, we completely understand. So please, 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 if you could instead, leave a review and a rating on iTunes or however your podcast app lets you do such a thing. It really, really does matter. Andrew, getting in touch with you.
Best way to do that would be via Twitter. If you search for Crack Windscreen, you will find me there. And Alan, if people want to tell you how they are not new car sales, what is the best way for them to do that with you?
They can just keep it to themselves. But if you want to tell me anything else, then Twitter again, at AJPBradley, BIADLEY. We'll be back next week. But until then, I've been Alan Bradley.
I've been Andrew Clues.
And safe motoring.